From Russia with Love by Ian Fleming, continued. Disc 3.
My dear, she said smoothly, how remiss of me. This promotion should be celebrated in a glass of wine. You must not think we senior officers are inhuman. We will drink together. It will be a good excuse to open a bottle of French champagne.
Rosa Klebb got up and went over to the sideboard where her batman had laid out what she had ordered.
Try one of these chocolates while I wrestle with the cork. It is never easy getting out champagne corks. We girls really need a man to help us with that sort of work, don't we?
The ghastly prattle went on as she put a spectacular box of chocolates in front of Tatiana. She went back to the sideboard.
They're from Switzerland, the very best. The soft centres are the round ones. The hard ones are square.
Tatiana murmured her thanks. She reached out and chose a round one. It would be easier to swallow. Her mouth was dry with fear of the moment when she would finally see the trap and feel it snap round her neck. It must be something dreadful to need to be concealed under all this play-acting. The bite of chocolate stuck in her mouth like chewing gum. Mercifully, the glass of champagne was thrust into her hand. Rosa Klebb stood over her. She lifted her glass merrily.
"Za vashe zdorovye, Comrade Tatiana, and my warmest congratulations."
Tatiana stitched a ghastly smile on her face. She picked up her glass and gave a little bow.
"Za vashe zdorovye, Comrade Colonel."
She drained the glass, as is the custom in Russian drinking, and put it down in front of her. Rosa Klebb immediately filled it again, slopping some over the tabletop.
"And now to the health of your new department, comrade."
She raised her glass. The sugary smile tightened as she watched the girl's reactions.
"To smash!"
Numbly, Tatiana got to her feet. She picked up the full glass.
"To smash!"
The word scarcely came out. She choked on the champagne and had to take two gulps. She sat heavily down. Rosa Klebb gave her no time for reflection. She sat down opposite and laid her hands flat on the table.
"And now to business, comrade."
Authority was back in the voice.
"There is much work to be done."
She leant forward.
"Have you ever wished to live abroad, comrade, in a foreign country?"
The champagne was having its effect on Tatiana. Probably worse was to come, but now let it come quickly.
"No, comrade, I am happy in Moscow."
"You have never thought what it might be like, living in the West? All those beautiful clothes, the jazz, the modern things?"
"No, comrade."
She was truthful. She had never thought about it.
"And if the state required you to live in the West?"
"I would obey."
"Willingly?"
Tatiana shrugged her shoulders with a hint of impatience.
"One does what one is told."
The woman paused. There was girlish conspiracy in the next question.
"Are you a virgin, comrade?"
Oh, my God, thought Tatiana.
"No, comrade colonel."
The wet lips glinted in the light.
"How many men?"
Tatiana coloured to the roots of her hair. Russian girls are reticent and prudish about sex. In Russia, the sexual climate is mid-Victorian. These questions from the Klebb woman were all the more revolting for being asked in this cold, inquisitorial tone by a state official she had never met before in her life. Tatiana screwed up her courage. She stared defensively into the yellow eyes.
"What is the purpose of these intimate questions, please, Comrade Colonel?"
Rosa Klebb straightened, her voice cut back like a whip.
"Remember yourself, comrade. You are not here to ask questions. You forget to whom you are speaking. Answer me."
Tatiana shrank back.
3 men, comrade colonel."
"When? And how old were you?"
The hard yellow eyes looked across the table into the hunted blue eyes of the girl and held them and commanded. Tatiana was on the edge of tears.
"At school, when I was 17. Then at the Institute of Foreign Languages, I was 22. Then last year, I was 23. It was a friend I met skating."
"Their names, please, comrade."
Rosa Klebb picked up a pencil and pulled a scribbling pad towards her. Tatiana covered her face with her hands and burst into tears.
"No," she cried between her sobs. "No, never. Whatever you do to me, you have no right."
"Stop that nonsense,"
the voice was a hiss.
"In 5 minutes I could have those names from you, or anything else I wish to know. You are playing a dangerous game with me, comrade. My patience will not last forever."
Rosa Klebb paused. She was being too rough.
"For the moment we will pass on. Tomorrow you will give me the names. No harm will come to these men. They will be asked 1 or 2 questions about you. Simple technical questions, that is all. Now sit up and dry your tears. We cannot have any more of this foolishness."
Rosa Klebb got up and came round the table. She stood looking down at Tatiana. The voice became oily and smooth.
"Come, come, my dear. You must trust me. Your little secrets are safe with me. Here, drink some more champagne and forget this little unpleasantness. We must be friends. We have work to do together. You must learn, my dear Tanya, to treat me as you would your mother. Here, drink this down."
Tatiana pulled a handkerchief out of the waistband of her skirt and dabbed at her eyes. She reached out a trembling hand for the glass of champagne and sipped at it with bowed head.
"Drink it down, my dear."
Rosa Klebb stood over the girl like some dreadful mother duck, clucking encouragement. Obediently, Tatiana emptied the glass. She felt drained of resistance, tired, willing to do anything to finish with this interview and get away somewhere and sleep. She thought, so this is what it is like on the interrogation table, and that is the voice the Klebb uses. Well, it was working. She was docile now. She would cooperate. Rosa Klebb sat down. She observed the girl appraisingly from behind the motherly mask.
"And now, my dear, just one more intimate little question, as between girls. Do you enjoy making love? Does it give you pleasure? Much pleasure?"
Tatiana's hands came up again and covered her face. From behind them, in a muffled voice, she said,
"Well, yes, comrade colonel. Naturally, when one is in love..."
Her voice trailed away. What else could she say? What answer did this woman want?
"And supposing, my dear, you were not in love, then would love-making with a man still give you pleasure?"
Tatiana shook her head indecisively. She took her hands down from her face and bowed her head. The hair fell down on either side in a heavy curtain. She was trying to think, to be helpful, but she couldn't imagine such a situation. She supposed,
"I suppose it would depend on the man, comrade colonel."
"That is a sensible answer, my dear."
Rosa Klebb opened a drawer in the table. She took out a photograph and slipped it across to the girl.
"What about this man, for instance?"
Tatiana drew the photograph cautiously towards her as if it might catch fire. She looked down warily at the handsome, ruthless face. She tried to think, to imagine.
"I cannot tell, comrade colonel. He is good-looking. Perhaps if he was gentle..."
She pushed the photograph anxiously away from her.
"No, keep it, my dear. Put it beside your bed and think of this man. You will learn more about him later in your new work. And now..."
The eyes glittered behind the square panes of glass.
"Would you like to know what your new work is to be? The task for which you have been chosen from all the girls in Russia?"
"Yes, indeed, comrade colonel."
Tatiana looked obediently across at the intent face that was now pointing at her like a gun dog. The wet, rubbery lips parted enticingly.
"It is a simple, delightful duty you have been chosen for, comrade corporal. A real labor of love, as we say. It is a matter of falling in love, that is all. Nothing else. Just falling in love with this man."
"But who is he? I don't even know him,"
Rosa Klebb's mouth revelled. This would give the silly chit of a girl something to think about.
He is an English spy.
Boje moi.
Tatiana clapped a hand over her mouth, as much to stifle the use of God's name as from terror. She sat, tense with the shock, and gazed at Rosa Klebb through wide, slightly drunk eyes.
Yes, said Rosa Klebb, pleased with the effect of her words. He is an English spy, perhaps the most famous of them all. And from now on you are in love with him, so you had better get used to the idea. And no silliness, comrade, we must be serious. This is an important state matter for which you have been chosen as the instrument, so no nonsense, please. Now for some practical details.
Rosa Klebb stopped. She said sharply,
And take your hand away from your silly face, and stop looking like a frightened cow. Sit up in your chair and pay attention, or it will be the worse for you. Understood?
Yes, comrade colonel.
Tatiana quickly straightened her back and sat up with her hands in her lap as if she was back at the security officer's school. Her mind was in a ferment, but this was no time for personal things. Her whole training told her that this was an operation for the state. She was now working for her country. Somehow she had come to be chosen for an important conspiratia. As an officer in the MGB, she must do her duty, and do it well. She listened carefully and with her whole professional attention.
"For the moment," Rosa Klebb put on her official voice, "I will be brief. You will hear more later. For the next few weeks you will be most carefully trained for this operation, until you know exactly what to do in all contingencies. You will be taught certain foreign customs. You will be equipped with beautiful clothes. You will be instructed in all the arts of allurement. Then you will be sent to a foreign country, somewhere in Europe. There you will meet this man, you will seduce him. In this matter you will have no silly compunctions. Your body belongs to the state. Since your birth, the state has nourished it. Now your body must work for the state. Is that understood?
Yes, comrade colonel.
The logic was inescapable.
You will accompany this man to England. There you will no doubt be questioned. The questioning will be easy. The English do not use harsh methods. You will give such answers as you can without endangering the state. We will supply you with certain answers which we would like to be given. You will probably be sent to Canada. That is where the English send a certain category of foreign prisoner. You will be rescued and brought back to Moscow.
Rosa Klebb peered at the girl. She seemed to be accepting all this without question.
You see, it is a comparatively simple matter. Have you any questions at this stage?
What will happen to the man, comrade colonel?
That is a matter of indifference to us. We shall simply use him as a means to introduce you into England. The object of the operation is to give false information to the British. We shall, of course, comrade, be very glad to have your own impressions of life in England. The reports of a highly trained and intelligent girl such as yourself will be of great value to the state.
Really, comrade colonel?
Tatiana felt important. Suddenly it all sounded exciting. If only she could do it well. She would assuredly do her very best. But supposing she could not make the English spy love her? She looked again at the photograph. She put her head on one side. It was an attractive face. What were these arts of allurement that the woman had talked about? What could they be? Perhaps they would help. Satisfied, Rosa Klebb got up from the table.
"And now we can relax, my dear. Work is over for the night. I will go and tidy up, and we will have a friendly chat together. I shan't be a moment. Eat up those chocolates, or they will go to waste."
Rosa Klebb made a vague gesture of the hand and disappeared with a preoccupied look into the next room. Tatiana sat back in her chair. So that was what it was all about. It really wasn't so bad after all. What a relief. And what an honour to have been chosen. How silly to have been so frightened. Naturally, the great leaders of the state would not allow harm to come to an innocent citizen who worked hard and had no black marks on her zapiska. Suddenly she felt immensely grateful to the father figure that was the state, and proud that she would now have a chance to repay some of her debt. Even the Kleb woman wasn't really so bad after all. Tatyana was still cheerfully reviewing the situation when the bedroom door opened and the Kleb woman appeared in the opening.
"What do you think of this, my dear?"
Colonel Kleb opened her dumpy arms and twirled on her toes like a mannequin. She struck a pose with one arm outstretched and the other arm crooked at her waist. Tatyana's mouth had fallen open. She shut it quickly. She searched for something to say. Colonel Kleb, of Smash, was wearing a semi-transparent nightgown in orange crepe de chine. It had scallops of the same material round the low, square neckline, and scallops at the wrists of the broadly flounced sleeves. Underneath could be seen a brassiere consisting of two large pink satin roses. Below, she wore old-fashioned knickers of pink satin with elastic above the knees. One dimpled knee, like a yellowish coconut, appeared thrust forward beneath the half-open folds of the nightgown in the classic stance of the modeller. The feet were enclosed in pink satin slippers with pompons of ostrich feathers. Rosa Kleb had taken off her spectacles, and her naked face was now thick with mascara and rouge and lipstick. She looked like the oldest and ugliest whore in the world. Tatyana stammered.
"It's very pretty."
"Isn't it?" twittered the woman.
She went over to a broad couch in the corner of the room. It was covered with a garish piece of peasant tapestry. At the back, against the wall, were rather grimy satin cushions in pastel colours. With a squeak of pleasure, Rosa Kleb threw herself down in the caricature of a Recamier pose. She reached up an arm and turned on a pink, shaded table lamp whose stem was a naked woman in sham lalique glass. She patted the couch beside her.
"Turn out the top light, my dear. The switch is by the door. Then come and sit beside me. We must get to know each other better."
Tatyana walked to the door. She switched off the top light. Her hand dropped decisively to the doorknob. She turned it and opened the door and stepped coolly out into the corridor. Suddenly her nerve broke. She banged the door shut behind her and ran wildly off down the corridor with her hands over her ears against the pursuing scream that never came. Chapter 10. The Fuse Burns. It was the morning of the next day. Colonel Kleb sat at her desk in the roomy office that was her headquarters in the underground basement of Smash. It was more an operations room than an office. One wall was completely papered with a map of the Western Hemisphere. The opposite wall was covered with the Eastern Hemisphere. Behind her desk, and within reach of her left hand, a telecrypton occasionally chattered out a signal en clair, duplicating another machine in the cipher department under the tall radio masts on the roof of the building. From time to time, when Colonel Kleb thought of it, she tore off the lengthening strip of tape and read through the signals. This was a formality. If anything important happened, her telephone would ring. Every agent of SMERSH throughout the world was controlled from this room, and it was a vigilant and iron control. The heavy face looked sullen and dissipated. The chicken skin under the eyes was pouched, and the whites of the eyes were veined with red. One of the three telephones at her side purred softly. She picked up the receiver.
"Send him in."
She turned to Kronstein, who sat, picking his teeth thoughtfully with an opened paperclip, in an armchair up against the left-hand wall under the toe of Africa.
"Granitsky."
Kronstein slowly turned his head and looked at the door. Red Grant came in and closed the door softly behind him. He walked up to the desk and stood looking down, obediently, almost hungrily, into the eyes of his commanding officer. Kronstein thought that he looked like a powerful mastiff, waiting to be fed. Rosa Kleb surveyed him coldly.
"Are you fit and ready for work?"
"Yes, Comrade Colonel."
"Let's have a look at you. Take off your clothes."
Red Grant showed no surprise. He took off his coat and, after looking around for somewhere to put it, dropped it on the floor. Then, unself-consciously, he took off the rest of his clothes and kicked off his shoes. The great red-brown body with its golden hair lit up the drab room. Grant stood relaxed, his hands held loosely at his sides and one knee bent slightly forward, as if he was posing for an art class. Rosa Klebb got to her feet and came round the desk. She studied the body minutely, prodding here, feeling there, as if she was buying a horse. She went behind the man and continued her minute inspection. Before she came back in front of him, Kronstein saw her slip something out of her jacket pocket and fit it into her hand. There was a glint of metal. The woman came round and stood close up to the man's gleaming stomach, her right arm behind her back. She held his eyes in hers. Suddenly, with terrific speed and the whole weight of her shoulder behind the blow, she whipped her right fist, loaded with a heavy brass knuckle duster, round and exactly into the solar plexus of the man. Whack! Grant let out a snort of surprise and pain. His knees gave slightly and then straightened. For a flash, the eyes closed tight with agony. Then they opened again, and glared redly down into the cold yellow probing eyes behind the square glasses. Apart from an angry flush on the skin just below the breastbone, Grant showed no ill effects from a blow that would have sent any normal man writhing to the ground. Rosa Klebb smiled grimly. She slipped the knuckle duster back in her pocket and walked to her desk and sat down. She looked across at Kronstein with a hint of pride.
"At least he is fit enough," she said.
Kronstein grunted. The naked man grinned with sly satisfaction. He brought up one hand and rubbed his stomach. Rosa Klebb sat back in her chair and watched him thoughtfully. Finally, she said,
"Comrade Granitsky, there is work for you. An important task. More important than anything you have attempted. It is a task that will earn you a medal."
Grant's eyes gleamed.
"For the target is a difficult and dangerous one. You will be in a foreign country and alone. Is that clear?"
"Yes, Comrade Colonel."
Grant was excited. Here was a chance for that big step forward. What would the medal be? The Order of Lenin? He listened carefully.
"The target is an English spy. You would like to kill an English spy?"
"Very much indeed, Comrade Colonel."
Grant's enthusiasm was genuine. He asked nothing better than to kill an Englishman. He had accounts to settle with the bastards.
"You will need many weeks of training and preparation. On this assignment you'll be operating in the guise of an English agent. Your manners and appearances are uncouth. You will have to learn at least some of the tricks," the voice sneered, "of a gentleman. You will be placed in the hands of a certain Englishman we have here, a former gentleman of the Foreign Office in London. It will be his task to make you pass as some sort of an English spy. They employ many different kinds of men. It should not be difficult. And you will have to learn many other things. The operation will be at the end of August, but you will start your training at once. There is much to be done. Put on your clothes and report back to the ADC. Understood?"
"Yes, Comrade Colonel."
Grant knew not to ask any questions. He scrambled into his clothes, indifferent to the woman's eyes on him, and walked over to the door, buttoning his jacket. He turned.
"Thank you, Comrade Colonel."
Rosa Klebb was writing up her note of the interview. She didn't answer or look up, and Grant went out and closed the door softly behind him. The woman threw down her pen and sat back.
"And now, Comrade Kronstein, are there any points to discuss before we put the full machinery in motion? I should mention that the Presidium has approved the target and ratified the death warrant. I have reported the broad lines of your plan to Comrade General Grubozoboyshikov. He is in agreement. The detailed execution has been left entirely in my hands. The combined planning and operation staff has been selected and is waiting to begin work. Have you any last-minute thoughts, comrade?"
Kronstein sat looking up at the ceiling, the tips of his fingers joined in front of him. He was indifferent to the condescension in the woman's voice. The pulse of concentration beat in his temples.
"This man, Kronitsky, he is reliable. You can trust him in a foreign country. He will not go private."
He has been tested for nearly 10 years. He has had many opportunities to escape. He has been watched for signs of itching feet. There has never been a breath of suspicion. The man is in the position of a drug addict. He would no more abandon the Soviet Union than a drugger would abandon the source of his cocaine. He is my top executioner. There is no one better.
And this girl, Romanova, she is satisfactory.
The woman said grudgingly,
"She is very beautiful. She will serve our purpose. She is not a virgin, but she is prudish and sexually unawakened. She will receive instruction. Her English is excellent. I have given her a certain version of her task and its object. She is cooperative. If she should show signs of faltering, I have the addresses of certain relatives, including children. I shall also have the names of her previous lovers. If necessary, it would be explained to her that these people will be hostages until her task is completed. She has an affectionate nature. Such a hint would be sufficient, but I do not anticipate any trouble from her."
"Romanova, that is the name of a Buivshi, of one of the former people. It seems odd to be using a Romanov for such a delicate task."
"Her grandparents were distantly related to the imperial family, but she does not frequent Buivshi circles. Anyway, all our grandparents were former people. There is nothing one can do about it."
"Our grandparents were not called Romanov," said Kronstein dryly. "However, so long as you are satisfied..."
He reflected a moment.
"And this man Bond, have we discovered his whereabouts?"
"Yes. The MGP English Network reports him in London. During the day he goes to his headquarters. At night he sleeps in his flat in a district of London called Chelsea."
"That is good. Let us hope he stays there for the next few weeks. That will mean that he is not engaged on some operation. He will be available to go out after our bait when they get the scent. Meanwhile..."
Kronstein's dark, pensive eyes continued to examine a particular point on the ceiling.
"I have been studying the suitability of centers abroad. I have decided on Istanbul for the first contact. We have a good apparat there. The Secret Service has only a small station. The head of the station is reported to be a good man. He will be liquidated. The center is conveniently placed for us, with short lines of communication with Bulgaria and the Black Sea. It is relatively far from London. I am working out details of the point of assassination and the means of getting this Bond there after he has contacted the girl. It will be either in France or very near it. We have excellent leverage on the French press. They will make the most of this kind of story, with its sensational disclosures of sex and espionage. It also remains to be decided when Granitsky shall enter the picture. These are minor details. We must choose the cameraman and the other operatives and move them quietly into Istanbul. There must be no crowding of our apparat there, no congestion, no unusual activity. We will warn all departments that wireless traffic with Turkey is to be kept absolutely normal before and during the operation. We don't want the British interceptors smelling a rat. The cipher department has agreed that there is no security objection to handing over the outer case of a Spectre machine. That will be attractive. The machine will go to the special devices section. They will handle its preparation."
Kronstein stopped talking. His gaze slowly came down from the ceiling. He rose thoughtfully to his feet. He looked across and into the watchful, intent eyes of the woman.
"I can think of nothing else at the moment, comrade," he said. "Many details will come up and have to be settled from day to day, but I think the operation can safely begin."
"I agree, comrade. The matter can now go forward. I will issue the necessary directives."
The harsh, authoritative voice unbent.
"I am grateful for your cooperation."
Kronstein lowered his head 1 inch in acknowledgement. He turned and walked softly out of the room. In the silence, the telecrypton gave a warning ping and started up its mechanical chatter. Rosa Klebb stirred in her chair and reached for one of the telephones. She dialed a number.
"Operations room," said a man's voice.
Rosa Klebb's pale eyes, gazing out across the room, lit on the pink shape on the wall map that was England. Her wet lips parted.
"Colonel Klebb speaking. The conspiracy against the English spy Bond. The operation will commence forthwith."
Part 2. The Execution. Chapter 11. The Soft Life. The blubbery arms of the Soft Life had Bond round the neck, and they were slowly strangling him. He was a man of war, and when, for a long period, there was no war, his spirit went into decline. In his particular line of business, peace had reigned for nearly a year, and peace was killing him. At 7:30 on the morning of Thursday, August the 12th, Bond awoke in his comfortable flat in the plain-treed square off the King's Road, and was disgusted to find that he was thoroughly bored with the prospect of the day ahead. Just as, in at least one religion, accidy is the first of the cardinal sins, so boredom, and particularly the incredible circumstance of waking up bored, was the only vice Bond utterly condemned. Bond reached out and gave two rings on the bell to show May, his treasured Scottish housekeeper, that he was ready for breakfast. Then he abruptly flung the single sheet off his naked body and swung his feet to the floor. There was only one way to deal with boredom. Kick oneself out of it. Bond went down on his hands and did 20 slow press-ups, lingering over each one so that his muscles had no rest. When his arms could stand the pain no longer, he rolled over on his back and, with his hands at his sides, did the straight leg lift until his stomach muscles screamed. He got to his feet and, after touching his toes 20 times, went over to arm and chest exercises, combined with deep breathing until he was dizzy. Panting with the exertion, he went into the big white-tiled bathroom and stood in the glass shower cabinet under very hot and then cold hissing water for 5 minutes. At last, after shaving and putting on a sleeveless dark blue Sea Island cotton shirt and navy blue tropical worsted trousers, he slipped his bare feet into black leather sandals and went through the bedroom into the long, big-windowed sitting room, with the satisfaction of having sweated his boredom, at any rate for the time being, out of his body. May, an elderly Scotswoman with iron-grey hair and a handsome, closed face, came in with the tray and put it on the table in the bay window, together with the Times, the only paper Bond ever read. Bond wished her good morning and sat down to breakfast.
"Good mornings."
To Bond, one of May's endearing qualities was that she would call no man Sir except—Bond had teased her about it years before—English Kings and Winston Churchill. As a mark of exceptional regard, she accorded Bond an occasional hint of an S at the end of a word. She stood by the table, while Bond folded his paper to the centre news page.
"Yon man was here again last night about the television."
"What man was that?" Bond looked along the headlines.
"Yon man that's always coming. 6 times he's been here pestering me since June. After what I said to him the first time about the sinful thing, you'd think he'd give up trying to sell us one. By hire, purchase too, if you please."
"Persistent chaps, these salesmen." Bond put down his paper and reached for the coffee pot.
"I gave him a right piece of my mind last night, disturbing folk at their supper. Asked him if he'd got any papers, anything to show who he was."
"I expect that fixed him." Bond filled his large coffee cup to the brim with black coffee.
"Not a bit of it. Flourished his union card. Said he had every right to earn his living. Electricians' union it was, too. They're the communist one, aren't they?"
"Yes, that's right," said Bond vaguely. His mind sharpened. Was it possible they could be keeping an eye on him? He took a sip of the coffee and put the cup down. "Exactly what did this man say, May?" he asked, keeping his voice indifferent, but looking up at her.
"He said he's selling television sets on commission in his spare time, and are we sure we don't want one? He says we're one of the only folk in the square that haven't got one. Sees there isn't one of these aerial things on the house, I dare say. He's always saying if you're at home so that he can have a word with you about it. Fancy his cheek. I'm surprised he hasn't thought to catch you coming in or going out. "'He's always asking if I'm expecting you home. "'Naturally, I don't tell him anything about your movements. "'Respectable, quiet-spoken body, if he wasn't so persistent.'
"'Could be,' thought Bond. "'There are many ways of checking up whether the owner's at home or away. "'A servant's appearance and reactions, a glance through the open door.' "'Well, you're wasting your time because he's away,' would be the obvious reaction if the flat was empty. Should he tell the security section? Bond shrugged his shoulders irritably. What the hell? There was probably nothing in it. Why would they be interested in him? And if there was something in it, security was quite capable of making him change his flat. "'I expect you frightened him away this time,' Bond smiled up at May. "'I should think you've heard the last of him.'
"'Yes,'
said May doubtfully. At any rate, she had carried out her orders to tell him if she saw anyone hanging about the place. She bustled off with a whisper of the old-fashioned black uniform she persisted in wearing even in the heat of August. Bond went back to his breakfast. Normally it was little straws in the wind like this that would start an intuitive ticking in his mind, and on other days he would not have been happy until he had solved the problem of the man from the Communist Union who kept on coming to the house. Now, from months of idleness and disuse, the sword was rusty in the scabbard, and Bond's mental guard was down. Breakfast was Bond's favourite meal of the day. When he was stationed in London, it was always the same. It consisted of very strong coffee from De Bry in New Oxford Street, brewed in an American Chemex, of which he drank two large cups, black and without sugar. The single egg in the dark blue egg cup, with a gold ring round the top, was boiled for 3 1/3 minutes. It was a very fresh, speckled brown egg from French Marin's hens owned by some friend of May in the country. Bond disliked white eggs, and faddish as he was in many small things, it amused him to maintain that there was such a thing as the perfect boiled egg. Then there were two thick slices of whole wheat toast, a large pat of deep yellow Jersey butter, and three squat glass jars containing Tiptree Little Scarlet Strawberry Jam, Cooper's Vintage Oxford Marmalade, and Norwegian Heather Honey from Fortnum's. The coffee pot and the silver on the tray were Queen Anne, and the china was Minton, of the same dark blue and gold and white as the egg cup. That morning, while Bond finished his breakfast with honey, he pinpointed the immediate cause of his lethargy and of his low spirits. To begin with, Tiffany Case, his love for so many happy months, had left him, and after final painful weeks during which he had withdrawn to an hotel, had sailed for America at the end of July. He missed her badly, and his mind still sheered away from the thought of her. And it was August, and London was hot and stale. He was due for leave, but he had not the energy or the desire to go off alone, or to try and find some temporary replacement for Tiffany to go with him. So he had stayed on in the half-empty headquarters of the Secret Service, grinding away at the old routines, snapping at his secretary, and rasping at his colleagues. Even M had finally got impatient with the surly, caged tiger on the floor below, and on Monday of this particular week he had sent Bond a sharp note, appointing him to a committee of inquiry under Paymaster Captain Troop. The note said that it was time Bond, as a senior officer in the service, took a hand in major administrative problems. Anyway, there was no one else available. Headquarters were short-handed, and the 00 section was quiescent. Bond would pray report that afternoon at 2:30 to room 412. It was Troop, reflected Bond as he lit his first cigarette of the day, who was the most nagging and immediate cause of his discontent. In every large business there is one man who is the office tyrant and bugbear, and who is cordially disliked by all the staff. This individual performs an unconsciously important role by acting as a kind of lightning conductor for the usual office hates and fears. In fact, he reduces their disruptive influence by providing them with a common target. The man is usually the general manager or the head of admin. He is that indispensable man who is a watchdog over the small things, petty cash, heat and light, towels and soap in the lavatories, stationery supplies, the canteen, the holiday rota, the punctuality of the staff. He is the one man who has real impact on the office comforts and amenities, and whose authority extends into the privacy and personal habits of the men and women of the organization. To want such a job, and to have the necessary qualifications for it, the man must have exactly those qualities which irritate and abrade. He must be parsimonious, observant, prying, and meticulous. And he must be a strong disciplinarian and indifferent to opinion. He must be a little dictator. In all well-run businesses there is such a man. In the Secret Service, it is Paymaster Captain Troop, R.N. retired, head of admin, whose job it is, in his own words, to keep the place ship-shape and Bristol fashion. It was inevitable that Captain Troop's duties would bring him into conflict with most of the organization, but it was particularly unfortunate that M. could think of no one but Troop to spare as chairman for this particular committee. For this was yet one more of those committees of inquiry dealing with the delicate intricacies of the Burgess and McLean case, and with the lessons that could be learned from it. M. had dreamed it up, 5 years after he had closed his own particular file on that case, purely as a sop to the Privy Council inquiry into the secret services which the Prime Minister had ordered in 1955. And once Bond had got into a hopeless wrangle with Troop over the employment of intellectuals in the Secret Service. Perversely, and knowing it would annoy, Bond had put forward the proposition that if MI5 and the Secret Service were to concern themselves seriously with the Atom Age intellectual spy, they must employ a certain number of intellectuals to counter them. "Retired officers of the Indian Army," Bond had pronounced, "can't possibly understand the thought processes of a Burgess or a McLean. They won't even know such people exist, let alone be in a position to frequent their cliques and get to know their friends and their secrets. Once Burgess and McLean went to Russia, the only way to make contact with them again, and perhaps, when they got tired of Russia, turn them into double agents against the Russians, would have been to send their closest friends to Moscow and Prague and Budapest, with orders to wait until one of these chaps crept out of the masonry and made contact. And one of them, probably Burgess, would have been driven to make contact by his loneliness, and by his ache to tell his story to someone. But they certainly wouldn't take the risk of revealing themselves to some man with a trench coat and a cavalry moustache and a beta-minus mind."
"Oh, really?"
Troop had said with icy calm. "So you suggest we should staff the organization with long-haired perverts? That's quite an original notion. I thought we were all agreed that homosexuals were about the worst security risk there is. I can't see the Americans handing over many atom secrets to a lot of pansies soaked in scent."
"All intellectuals aren't homosexual, and many of them are bald. I'm just saying that..."
And so the argument had gone on intermittently through the hearings of the past 3 days, and the other committee members had ranged themselves more or less with Troop. Now, today, they had to draw up their recommendations, and Bond was wondering whether to take the unpopular step of entering a minority report. How seriously did he feel about the whole question? Bond wondered as, at 9 o'clock, he walked out of his flat and down the steps to his car. Was he just being petty and obstinate? Had he constituted himself into a one-man opposition only to give his teeth something to bite into? Was he so bored that he could find nothing better to do than make a nuisance of himself inside his own organization? Bond couldn't make up his mind. He felt restless and indecisive, and, behind it all, there was a nagging disquiet he couldn't put his finger on. As he pressed the self-starter, and the twin exhausts of the Bentley woke to their fluttering growl, a curious bastard quotation slipped from nowhere into Bond's mind. "Those whom the gods wish to destroy, they first make bored."
Chapter 12. A Piece of Cake. As it turned out, Bond never had to make a decision on the committee's final report. He had complimented his secretary on a new summer frock, and was halfway through the file of signals that had come in during the night, when the red telephone that could only mean M, or his chief of staff, gave its soft peremptory burr. Bond picked up the receiver. "007?"
"Can you come up?"
It was the chief of staff.
"M?" "Yes, and it looks like a long session. I've told Troop you won't be able to make the committee."
"Any idea what it's about?"
The chief of staff chuckled. "Well, I have, as a matter of fact, but you'd better hear about it from him. It'll make you sit up. There's quite a swerve on this one."
As Bond put on his coat and went out into the corridor, banging the door behind him, he had a feeling of certainty that the starter's gun had fired and that the dog days had come to an end. Even the ride up to the top floor in the lift, and the walk down the long, quiet corridor to the door of M's staff office, seemed to be charged with the significance of all those other occasions when the bell of the red telephone had been the signal that had fired him like a loaded projectile across the world towards some distant target of M's choosing. And the eyes of Miss Moneypenny, M's private secretary, had that old look of excitement and secret knowledge as she smiled up at him and pressed the switch on the intercom.
007's here, sir.
Send him in,
said the metallic voice, and the red light of privacy went on above the door. Bond went through the door and closed it softly behind him. The room was cool, or perhaps it was the Venetian blinds that gave an impression of coolness. They threw bars of light and shadow across the dark green carpet up to the edge of the big central desk. There the sunshine stopped, so that the quiet figure behind the desk sat in a pool of suffused greenish shade. In the ceiling directly above the desk, a big, twin-bladed tropical fan, a recent addition to M's room, slowly revolved, shifting the thundery August air that, even high up above the Regent's Park, was heavy and stale after a week of heat wave. M gestured to the chair opposite him across the red leather desk. Bond sat down and looked across into the tranquil, lined sailor's face that he loved, honoured, and obeyed.
"Do you mind if I ask you a personal question, James?"
M never asked his staff personal questions, and Bond couldn't imagine what was coming. "No, sir." M picked his pipe out of the big copper ashtray and began to fill it, thoughtfully watching his fingers at work with the tobacco. He said harshly,
"You needn't answer, but it's to do with your friend, Miss Case. As you know, I don't generally interest myself in these matters. But I did hear that you had been seeing a lot of each other since that diamond business. Even some idea you might be going to get married."
M glanced up at Bond and then down again. He put the loaded pipe into his mouth and set a match to it. Out of the corner of his mouth, as he drew at the jigging flame, he said,
"Care to tell me anything about it?"
"Now what?" wondered Bond. "Damn these office gossips." He said gruffly, "Well, sir, we did get on well, and there was some idea we might get married, but then she met some chap in the American Embassy, on the military attaché's staff, Marine Corps Major, and I gather she's going to marry him. They've both gone back to the States, as a matter of fact. Probably better that way. Mixed marriages aren't often a success. I gather he's a nice enough fellow, probably suit her better than living in London. She couldn't really settle down here. Fine girl, but she's a bit neurotic. We had too many rows. Probably my fault. Anyway, it's over now." M gave one of the brief smiles that lit up his eyes more than his mouth.
"I'm sorry if it went wrong, James," he said.
There was no sympathy in M's voice. He disapproved of Bond's womanizing, as he called it to himself, while recognizing that his prejudice was the relic of a Victorian upbringing. But as Bond's chief, the last thing he wanted was for Bond to be permanently tied to one woman's skirts.
"Perhaps it's for the best. Doesn't do to get mixed up with neurotic women in this business. They hang on your gun arm, if you know what I mean. Forgive me for asking about it. Had to know the answer before I told you what's come up. It's a pretty odd business. Be difficult to get you involved if you were on the edge of marrying or anything of that sort."
Bond shook his head, waiting for the story.
"All right, then," said M.
There was a note of relief in his voice. He leaned back in his chair and gave several quick pulls on his pipe to get it going.
"This is what's happened. Yesterday there was a long signal in from Istanbul. Seems on Tuesday the head of Station T got an anonymous typewritten message which told him to take a round ticket on the 8 p.m. ferry steamer from the Galata Bridge to the mouth of the Bosphorus and back. Nothing else. Head of T's an adventurous sort of chap, and of course he took the steamer. He stood up forward by the rail and waited. After about a quarter of an hour, a girl came and stood beside him, a Russian girl, very good-looking, he says, and after they talked a bit about the view and so on, she suddenly switched, and in the same sort of conversational voice, she told him an extraordinary story."
M paused to put another match to his pipe. Bond interjected, "Who is head of T, sir? I've never worked in Turkey."
"'Man called Kerim, Darko Kerim, Turkish father and English mother. "'Remarkable fellow. "'Been head of tea since before the war. "'One of the best men we've got anywhere. "'Does a wonderful job, loves it. "'Very intelligent, and he knows all that part of the world like the back of his hand.'
M dismissed Kerim with a sideways jerk of his pipe.
"'Anyway, the girl's story was that she was a corporal in the MGB.' "'Had been in the show since she left school "'and had just got transferred to the Istanbul Centre "'as a cipher officer. "'She'd engineered the transfer "'because she wanted to get out of Russia and come over.'
"'That's good,' said Bond. "'Might be useful to have one of their cipher girls. "'But why does she want to come over?' "'M looked across the table at Bond.
"'Because she's in love.'
"'He paused and added mildly,
"'She says she's in love with you.'
"'In love with me?'
"'Yes, with you. "'That's what she says. "'Her name's Tatyana Romanova. "'Ever heard of her?'
"'Good God, no. "'I mean, no, sir.' "'M smiled at the mixture of expressions on Bond's face. "'But what the hell does she mean? "'Has she ever met me? "'How does she know I exist?' "'Well,' said M,
"'the whole thing sounds absolutely ridiculous. "'But it's so crazy that it just might be true.' "'This girl is 24. "'Ever since she joined the MGB, "'she's been working in their central index, "'the same as our records. "'And she's been working in the English section of it. "'She's been there 6 years. "'One of the files she had to deal with was yours.'
"'I'd like to see that one,' commented Bond.
"'Her story is that she first took a fancy "'to the photographs they've got of you. "'Admired your looks, and so on.'
"'M's mouth turned downwards at the corners, "'as if he had just sucked at a lemon.'
She read up all your cases, decided that you were the hell of a fellow.
Bond looked down his nose. M's face was non-committal.
She said you particularly appealed to her because you reminded her of the hero of a book by some Russian fellow called Lermontov. Apparently it was her favourite book. This hero chap liked gambling and spent his whole time getting in and out of scraps. Anyway, you reminded her of him. She says she came to think of nothing else, and one day the idea came to her— that if only she could transfer to one of their foreign centres, she could get in touch with you and you would come and rescue her.
I've never heard of such a crazy story, sir. Surely Head of Tea didn't swallow it.
Now, wait a moment.
M's voice was testy. Just don't be in too much of a hurry, simply because something's turned up you've never come across before.
Suppose you happened to be a film star instead of being in this particular trade. You'd get daft letters from girls all over the world, stuffed with heaven knows what sort of rot about not being able to live without you and so on. Here's a silly girl doing a secretary's job in Moscow. Probably the whole department is staffed by women, like our records. Not a man in the room to look at, and here she is, faced with your dashing features on a file that's constantly coming up for review. And she gets what I believe they call a crush on these pictures. Just as secretaries all over the world get crushes on these dreadful faces in the magazines.
M waved his pipe sideways to indicate his ignorance of these grisly female habits.
The Lord knows I don't know much about these things, but you must admit that they happen.
Bond smiled at the appeal for help.
Well, as a matter of fact, sir, I'm beginning to see there is some sense in it.
There's no reason why a Russian girl shouldn't be just as silly as an English one. But she must have got guts to do what she did. Does Head of Tea say if she realized the consequences if she was found out?
He said she was frightened out of her wits, said M. Spent the whole time on the boat looking round to see if anybody was watching her. But it seems they were the usual peasants and commuters that take these boats. And as it was a late boat, there weren't many passengers anyway. But wait a minute, you haven't heard half of the story.
M took a long pull at his pipe and blew a cloud of smoke up towards the slowly turning fan above his head. Bond watched the smoke get caught up in the blades and whirled into nothingness.
She told Kerim that this passion for you gradually developed into a phobia. She got to hate the sight of Russian men. In time this turned into a dislike of the regime, and particularly of the work she was doing for them, and, so to speak, against you. So she applied for a transfer abroad— and since her languages were very good, English and French, in due course she was offered Istanbul if she would join the cipher department, which meant a cut in pay. To cut a long story short, after 6 months' training, she got to Istanbul about 3 weeks ago.
Then she sniffed about and soon got hold of the name of our man, Kerim. He's been there so long that everybody in Turkey knows what he does by now. He doesn't mind, and it takes people's eyes off the special men we send in from time to time. There's no harm in having a front man in some of these places. Quite a lot of customers would come to us if they knew where to go and who to talk to. Bond commented, "The public agent often does better than the man who has to spend a lot of time and energy keeping undercover." So she sent Kerim the note. Now she wants to know if he can help her. M paused and sucked thoughtfully at his pipe. Of course, Kerim's first reactions were exactly the same as yours, and he fished around looking for a trap. But he simply couldn't see what the Russians could gain from sending this girl over to us. All this time the steamer was getting further and further up the Bosphorus, and soon it would be turning to come back to Istanbul. And the girl got more and more desperate as Kerim went on trying to break down her story. Then, M's eyes glittered softly across at Bond, came the clincher. That glitter in M's eyes, thought Bond, how well he knew those moments when M's cold grey eyes betrayed their excitement and their greed. She had a last card to play, and she knew it was the ace of trumps. If she could come over to us, she would bring her cipher machine with her. It's the brand new Spectre machine, the thing we'd give our eyes to have. God, said Bond softly, his mind boggling at the immensity of the prize. The Spectre, the machine that would allow them to decipher the top-secret traffic of all. To have that, even if its loss was immediately discovered and the settings changed, or the machine taken out of service in Russian embassies and spy centres all over the world, would be a priceless victory. Bond didn't know much about cryptography, and, for security's sake, in case he was ever captured, wished to know as little as possible about its secrets. But at least he knew that, in the Russian Secret Service, loss of the Spectre would be counted a major disaster. Bond was sold. At once he accepted all M's faith in the girl's story, however crazy it might be. For a Russian to bring them this gift, and take the appalling risk of bringing it, could only mean an act of desperation, of desperate infatuation, if you liked. Whether the girl's story was true or not, the stakes were too high to turn down the gamble.
"You see, 007?
Said M softly. It was not difficult to read Bond's mind from the excitement in his eyes.
"You see what I mean?"
Bond hedged. But did she say how she could do it?
Not exactly. But Kerim says she was absolutely definite. Some business about night duty. Apparently she's on duty alone certain nights of the week and sleeps on a camp bed in the office. She seemed to have no doubts about it, although she realized that she would be shot out of hand if anyone ever dreamed of her plan. She was even worried about Kerim reporting all this back to me, made him promise he would encode the signal himself and send it on a one-time-only pad and keep no copy. Well, naturally, he did as she asked. Directly she mentioned the Spectre, Kerim knew he might be onto the most important coup that's come our way since the war.
What happened then, sir?
The steamer was coming up to a place called Ortaköy. She said she was going to get off there. Kerim promised to get a signal off that night. She refused to make any arrangements for staying in touch, just said that she would keep her end of the bargain if we would keep ours. She said good night and mixed in the crowd going down the gangplank, and that was the last Kerim saw of her.
Bond said nothing. He thought he could guess what was coming.
This girl will only do these things on one condition.
M's eyes narrowed, until they were fierce, significant slits.
That you go out to Istanbul and bring her and the machine back to England.
Bond shrugged his shoulders. That presented no difficulty, but he looked candidly back at M. Should be a piece of cake, sir. As far as I can see, there's only one snag. She's only seen photographs of me and read a lot of exciting stories. Suppose that when she sees me in the flesh, I don't come up to her expectations.
That's where the work comes in, said M grimly. That's why I asked those questions about Miss Case. It's up to you to see that you do come up to her expectations.
Chapter 13. BEA Takes You There. The four small, square-ended propellers turned slowly, one by one, and became four whizzing pools. The low hum of the turbojets rose to a shrill, smooth whine.
The quality of the noise, and the complete absence of vibration, were different from the stuttering roar and straining horsepower of all other aircraft Bond had flown in. As the Viscount wheeled easily out to the shimmering east-west runway of London Airport, Bond felt as if he was sitting in an expensive mechanical toy. There was a pause, as the chief pilot gunned up the four turbojets into a banshee scream, and then, with a jerk of released brakes, the 10:30 BEA Flight 130 to Rome, Athens and Istanbul gathered speed and hurtled down the runway and up into a quick, easy climb. In 10 minutes they had reached 20,000 feet, and were heading south along the wide air channel that takes the Mediterranean traffic from England. The scream of the jets died to a low, drowsy whistle. Bond unfastened his seatbelt and lit a cigarette. He reached for the slim, expensive-looking attaché case on the floor beside him and took out The Mask of Demetrius by Eric Ambler, and put the case, which was very heavy in spite of its size, on the seat beside him. He thought how surprised the ticket clerk at London Airport would have been if she had weighed the case instead of letting it go unchecked as an overnight bag. And if, in their turn, customs had been intrigued by its weight, how interested they would have been when it was slipped under the inspectorscope. Q Branch had put together this smart-looking little bag, ripping out the careful handiwork of Swain and Adney, to pack 50 rounds of 2.5 ammunition in 2 flat rows between the leather and the lining of the spine. In each of the innocent sides there was a flat throwing knife, built by Wilkinson's, the sword makers, and the tops of their handles were concealed cleverly by the stitching at the corners. Despite Bond's efforts to laugh them out of it, Q's craftsmen had insisted on building a hidden compartment into the handle of the case, which, by pressure at a certain point, would deliver a cyanide death pill into the palm of his hand. Directly he had taken delivery of the case, Bond had washed this pill down the lavatory. More important was the thick tube of palmolive shaving cream in the otherwise guileless sponge bag. The whole top of this unscrewed to reveal the silencer for the Beretta, packed in cotton wool. In case hard cash was needed, the lid of the attaché case contained 50 golden sovereigns. These could be poured out by slipping sideways one ridge of welting. The complicated bag of tricks amused Bond, but he also had to admit that, despite its 8-pound weight, the bag was a convenient way of carrying the tools of his trade, which otherwise would have to be concealed about his body. Only 12 miscellaneous passengers were on the plane. Bond smiled at the thought of Luella Ponsonby's horror if she knew that that made the load 13. The day before, when he had left M and had gone back to his office to arrange the details of his flight, his secretary had protested violently at the idea of his travelling on Friday the 13th. "But it's always best to travel on the 13th," Bond had explained patiently. "There are practically no passengers, and it's more comfortable, and you get better service. I always choose the 13th when I can." "Well," she had said resignedly, "it's your funeral. But I shall spend the day worrying about you, and for heaven's sake don't go walking under ladders or anything silly this afternoon. You oughtn't to overplay your luck like this. I don't know what you're going to Turkey for, and I don't want to know, but I have a feeling in my bones."
"Ah, those beautiful bones," Bond had teased her. "I'll take them out to dinner the night I get back."
"You'll do nothing of the sort," she had said coldly.
Later she had kissed him goodbye with a sudden warmth, and for the 100th time Bond had wondered why he bothered with other women when the most darling of them all was his secretary. The plane sang steadily on above the endless sea of whipped cream clouds that looked solid enough to land on if the engines failed. The clouds broke up, and a distant blue haze, far away to their left, was Paris. For an hour they flew high over the burned-up fields of France, until, after Dijon, the land turned from a pale to a darker green as it sloped up into the Juras. Lunch came. Bond put aside his book and the thoughts that kept coming between him and the printed page, and while he ate, he gazed down at the cool mirror of the Lake of Geneva. As the pine forests began to climb towards the snow patches between the beautifully scarred teeth of the Alps, he remembered early skiing holidays. The plane skirted the great eye-tooth of Mont Blanc, a few 100 yards to port, and Bond looked down at the dirty grey elephant's skin of the glaciers, and saw himself again, a young man in his teens with the leading end of the rope round his waist, bracing himself against the top of a rock chimney on the Aiguille Rouge, as his two companions from the University of Geneva inched up the smooth rock towards him. And now,
Bond smiled wryly at his reflection in the perspex as the plane swung out of the mountains and over the gross-grained terrazza of Lombardy. If that young James Bond came up to him in the street and talked to him, would he recognize the clean, eager youth that had been him at 17? And what would that youth think of him, the secret agent, the older James Bond? Would he recognize himself beneath the surface of this man who was tarnished with years of treachery and ruthlessness and fear? This man with the cold, arrogant eyes, and the scar down his cheek and the flat bulge beneath his left armpit? If the youth did recognize him, what would his judgment be? What would he think of Bond's present assignment? What would he think of the dashing secret agent who was off across the world in a new and most romantic role to pimp for England? Bond put the thought of his dead youth out of his mind. Never job backwards. What might have been was a waste of time. Follow your fate and be satisfied with it, and be glad not to be a second-hand motor salesman, or a yellow press journalist pickled in gin and nicotine, or a cripple, or dead. Gazing down on the sun-baked sprawl of Genoa and the gentle blue waters of the Mediterranean, Bond closed his mind to the past and focused it on the immediate future, on this business, as he sourly described it to himself, of pimping for England. For that, however else one might like to describe it, was what he was on his way to do, to seduce, and seduce very quickly, a girl whom he had never seen before, whose name he had heard yesterday for the first time. And all the while, however attractive she was, and Head of Tea had described her as very beautiful, Bond's whole mind would have to be not on what she was, but on what she had, the dowry she was bringing with her. It would be like trying to marry a rich woman for her money. Would he be able to act the part? Perhaps he could make the right faces and say the right things, but would his body dissociate itself from his secret thoughts and effectively make the love he would declare? How did men behave credibly in bed when their whole minds were focused on a woman's bank balance? Perhaps there was an erotic stimulus in the notion that one was ravaging a sack of gold, but a cipher machine? Elba passed below them and the plane slid into its 50-mile glide towards Rome. Half an hour among the jabbering loudspeakers of Ciampino Airport, time to drink two excellent Americanos, and they were on their way again, flying steadily down towards the toe of Italy. And Bond's mind went back to sifting the minutest details of the rendezvous that was drawing closer at 300 miles an hour. Was it all a complicated MGB plot of which he couldn't find the key? Was he walking into some trap that not even the tortuous mind of M could fathom? God knew M was worried about the possibility of such a trap. Every conceivable angle of the evidence for and against had been scrutinized, not only by M, but also by a full-dress operations meeting of heads of sections that had worked all through the afternoon and evening before. But, whichever way the case had been examined, no one had been able to suggest what the Russians might get out of it. They might want to kidnap Bond and interrogate him. But why Bond? He was an operating agent, unconcerned with the general working of the service, carrying in his head nothing of use to the Russians except the details of his current duty and a certain amount of background information that could not possibly be vital. Or they might want to kill Bond as an act of revenge. Yet he had not come up against them for 2 years. If they wanted to kill him, they had only to shoot him in the streets of London, or in his flat, or put a bomb in his car. Bond's thoughts were interrupted by the stewardess. "Fasten your seat belts, please." As she spoke, the plane dropped sickeningly and soared up again with an ugly note of strain in the scream of the jets. The sky outside was suddenly black. Rain hammered on the windows. There came a blinding flash of blue and white light and a crash as if an anti-aircraft shell had hit them, and the plane heaved and bucketed in the belly of the electric storm that had ambushed them out of the mouth of the Adriatic. Bond smelt the smell of danger. It is a real smell, something like the mixture of sweat and electricity you get in an amusement arcade. Again the lightning flung its hands across the windows. Crash! It felt as if they were the centre of the thunderclap. Suddenly the plane seemed incredibly small and frail. 13 passengers. Friday the 13th. Bond thought of Louilia Ponsonby's words, and his hands on the arms of his chair felt wet. How old is this plane, he wondered. How many flying hours has it done? Had the Death Watch beetle of metal fatigue got into the wings? How much of their strength had it eaten away? Perhaps he wouldn't get to Istanbul after all. Perhaps a plummeting crash into the Gulf of Corinth was going to be the destiny he had been scanning philosophically only an hour before. In the centre of Bond was a hurricane room, the kind of citadel found in old-fashioned houses in the tropics. These rooms are small, strongly built cells in the heart of the house, in the middle of the ground floor and sometimes dug down into its foundations. To this cell the owner and his family retire if the storm threatens to destroy the house, and they stay there until the danger is past. Bond went to his hurricane room only when the situation was beyond his control and no other possible action could be taken. Now he retired to this citadel, closed his mind to the hell of noise and violent movement, and focused on a single stitch in the back of the seat in front of him, waiting with slackened nerves for whatever fate had decided for BEA flight number 130. Almost at once it got lighter in the cabin. The rain stopped crashing on the Perspex window, and the noise of the jets settled back into their imperturbable whistle. Bond opened the door of his hurricane room and stepped out. He slowly turned his head and looked curiously out of the window and watched the tiny shadow of the plane hastening far below across the quiet waters of the Gulf of Corinth. He heaved a deep sigh and reached into his hip pocket for his gunmetal cigarette case. He was pleased to see his hands were dead steady as he took out his lighter and lit one of the Morland cigarettes with the three gold rings. Should he tell Lil that perhaps she had almost been right? He decided that if he could find a rude enough postcard in Istanbul, he would. The day outside faded through the colours of a dying dolphin, and Mount Hymettus came at them, blue in the dusk, down over the twinkling sprawl of Athens, and then the Viscount was wheeling across the standard concrete airstrip, with its drooping windsock and the notices in the strange dancing letters Bond had hardly seen since school. Bond climbed out of the plane with a handful of pale, silent passengers, and walked across to the transit lounge and up to the bar. He ordered a tumbler of ouzo and drank it down and chased it with a mouthful of ice water. There was a strong bite under the sickly anisette taste, and Bond felt the drink light a quick, small fire down his throat and in his stomach. He put down his glass and ordered another. This book is continued on Disc 4.